Hello and welcome to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, the bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I'm Mike Bowler and I will be your host for this episode. This will be episode 58, and I'm going to be talking about Leslie Grogan and the SS Lurline. This particular story is linked to the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, where many conspiracy theorists have been trying to promote the idea that the Japanese broke radio silence as they were heading toward Hawaii, and the United States knew about it and ignored the potential for the attack. And I'm actually doing this show because a listener had made a comment, and I will kind of paraphrase it here a little bit. On Pearl Harbor and Grogan, how can you debunk the fact that his directional finding equipment led him to state that the Kido Butai stopped on December 7th? He reported this on December 3rd. This info was not released to the public until years after the war. He goes through much of the Grogan story. I'm going to save that for the actual show. And, toward the end of it, nonetheless, American sources have left unchallenged Japanese claim of total silence. No records that might contradict the Japanese claim have been released by the United States, the widely held assumption being that there could be none. Grogan's account suggests otherwise. As you can read, Grogan could not have known the attack force had stopped to refuel because this info was not released until years after the war. Need an answer on how Grogan knew. So, how can I debunk this? And I kind of took a look at this, but before I go into it, because I can tear this story all to shreds, but for you listeners who are not familiar with this story, I'm going to first, the actual Grogan story. I'll start with the actual Grogan story and then how the media took over and, embellished his story. But basically, this is a story about, Leslie Grogan. He was the assistant radio operator on the SS Lurline. This was a passenger ship of the Marston Line, who the Marston Line had a number of ships in the Pacific in the 40s. Actually, I believe the last Marston ship, if I'm going by some of the fan sites of the Marston ships, may have been disbanded, or many of the passenger ships had stopped in the late 60s. But in this case, the SS Lurline made regular scheduled stops in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Honolulu, Hawaii. On this particular trip, the Lurline left San Francisco on November 30th, 1941, en route to Honolulu. And on the night of December 3rd, Leslie Grogan was practicing radio. He was the assistant radio operator and had tuned in some radio stations in Japan. This would be a commercial station, JCS and JOS, and noted that these signals these commercial stations had switched over to broadcasting coded messages, and that antennas northwest of Hawaii was repeating these messages key for key, as if the keys were locked together. He did the same thing on December 3rd and came to this conclusion, according to Grogan, that these were naval orders for the attack on Pearl Harbor. Of course, this is December 3rd, a few days before the attack. How could he know? And I'll comment on this here in a little bit. So upon arrival on the 5th in Honolulu, Grogan and the head radio operator, Rudy Asplund, went to the 4th Naval District to file a report. The duty officer took the report and thanked them, and they were on their way. On the return trip on December 7th, they learned that Pearl Harbor was attacked. So upon arrival in San Francisco on December 10th, Grogan wrote a report that was going to be, that he was going to file with the Marston Line and keep a copy to himself. Upon arrival in San Francisco, the Lurline's log books, the ship log and the radio log, were seized by authorities and has since disappeared. And this is really the basic story. This first appears in Ladius Ferrango's book, The Broken Seal. Now, it wasn't in the first printing, but it was in the second paperback printing as a postscript. Apparently, Grogan, when the Broken Seal was like one of the earliest books on Pearl Harbor. This came out, the first printing was in 1967. His story appears in 1968. And that possibly because this is like one of the first books discussing the intelligence, perhaps he approached Ferrango and relayed his story. That's what seems to happen. Appears that there was an interview at that time, though I cannot find any notes or any evidence of notes of that interview. And unfortunately, I couldn't find the second printing, so I can't speak to exactly what was in it in his story, because the second time when I learned about it was from John Tolan's book, Infamy. And if you were to check the footnotes, the chapter that Tolan writes about Grogan is directly quotes Ferrango's book, The Broken Seal. So I'm kind of hoping that Tolan took the story in its entirety and didn't embellish too much. But unfortunately, now while Tolan is a very excellent writer, I actually do enjoy, and I think one of his best books was The Rising Sun. This book covers the political and social and the history of Japan from the 20s to 1945 and gives a really good rendition of the situation in Japan, how Japan politically, the political thought, how the military thought, and really goes into really nice details on the various operations, battles, and so on. Unfortunately, Infamy turns out to be more of a revisionist work, and actually the chapter for the Lurline is also linked to the Seaman Z story. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about Seaman Z, but one of the first and earliest problems I had with the Grogan story was that in this chapter, in talking about Seaman Z, now the Seaman's, I'll give you a quick run through on this, because the Seaman Z story was, at the time it was an anonymous, interview. The person in question didn't want to be identified. And according to in the book, that he had saw a chart tracking Japanese naval elements in the North Pacific. The problem is that later, Robert Ogg came forward and recanted everything that was in Tolan's book, even coming out and saying that Tolan misrepresented his story. And what he really said was that he did see a map, but it was a map of merchant shipping that had been crossing the Pacific, and the U.S. had been tracking those. So, yeah, the Tolan, this is like one of the earliest red flags of these that I got from the story. So when I started looking at Grogan himself and the story, I'm going to call these red flags, something that not necessarily a deal breaker, but it should be considered, or at least should raise the question. So, as we know from the story, Grogan claims that these signals were coming from the northwest of Hawaii. And somehow he identifies them as military signals. Now, he was a reserve officer. He may have worked in cryptography, but he was, in a later story, he was 47 in 1941 and working for a commercial, in a military capacity. How would he know that what he was listening to was a military signal? And of course, many of the authors who have promoted the Grogan story fails to mention that not only did the Japanese Navy have their own set of codes, the Japanese fishing fleet and the merchant fleet also had codes that they would communicate back and forth. I'll explain some, add more to this part a little bit later when I kind of talk about Japan as a country in 1941. So there's really nothing really saying that why did Grogan automatically assume it was a military signal, not a commercial or, you know, a civilian code system. Another problem is that this story, when he related to Ferengo, was in 1967. It would eventually be published in 68. This is roughly about 26 years after the fact. It's an awful long time to hold on to a story and trying to then re-relate this or try to, there's no explanation why he waited 26 years to get this story out. Now, one might think, again, Ferengo may have been the first one to do a book on radio cryptography in the Pacific War. The thing was, in 1945, John Flynn had already started railing on the idea that America had advanced knowledge of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Literally, as the ink was drying on the Articles of Surrender, Flynn plastered across the Chicago Tribune front page that the U.S. knew Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked. Flynn was talking about was the purple decodes that had, this was the diplomatic codes that Washington had been listening to. When you hear about it, you hear about magic. This was, it's a machine coded messages. Japan didn't think they could be broken, but they were broke. Oddly enough, Robert Ogg, Seaman Z, his job was to collect the recordings from the RCA radio station in Bainbridge Island to put these recordings on an airplane to Washington to be decoded. That's about the only link Ogg has to, or the closest he can get to the actual messages. He probably put the 14 parts on the plane to be decoded. And we really don't, and another problem is we really don't know who Grogan really was. At least in the Tolan story, the only thing we know really about him was that he was a assistant radio operator and he had 30 years experience crossing the Pacific. Okay. When I started trying to figure out, okay, did he have 30 years experience in December of 1941? Did he have 30 years experience in 1967? Did he have that in 1981 when Tolan wrote about it? We don't know. We have no basis. We have no idea how old this guy was. It would be later in Robert Stinnett's book that he would pin the age at 47, which would make Grogan 73 years old when he relates the story to Ferengo. If we kind of play around here a little bit, I was trying to figure out how old he might have been when he related the story to Ferengo. If he had 30 years experience in 1941, in 1967, he could have been anywhere from 66 to 76 years old. If he had 30 years experience in 1967, that would have made him between 40 and 50 years old. But then again, he would only have had a couple years experience when in 1941. So if I use the 47 in 1941, a 73-year-old trying to remember what happened 26 years earlier, again, not that it's impossible, it just, again, raises a red flag. Now, I kind of stop at the Ferengo and Tolan versions of the story because stories after this kind of go in all sorts of wild directions. Robert Stinnett in his book Day of Deceit screws up the story pretty bad. He says that on December 3rd, the report was given to 14th Naval District, where on the 3rd, there was no way the ship could have been in port. It's a 4.5-day trip. They left on the 30th. It would have put the ship in on December 5th. Then there's a few other embellishments that he was an expert radio operator. There's one made a comment that he was a 290-pound blimp. I don't want to start speculating on that type of stuff. And this is when I looked at it, it's like, okay, but he did say that he was receiving these signals, and it seemed if he's a radio operator, he should understand radio direction finding, because that's what he was doing. That's how he got the northwest and west of northwest of Hawaii directions. So I played devil's advocate. I mean, I'm always open to new ideas, and this particular listener, apparently though, most of his comment looks like it was taken from a website from another author, Timothy Wilford. And it does seem like, may even been directly from a article in the Northern Mariner, volume 11, number 2, April 2001, where he argues that on the third, that Grogan had, delivered these messages to, the 14th Naval District, whereas the ship could never have been there. Actually it arrived on the 5th. So this is again, a lot of, highly questionable, but when I started to, I wanted to take a closer look at the real facts that Grogan presents. Now he talks about hearing signals northwest of Hawaii, Honolulu. And when I began to look at it, I started realizing, and I started pulling up some maps on the Pacific and to do what you would use for radio direction finding, a few things began to click. So, I'm going to start off, and I'm going to do this just for you folks. That it's a very key point is what you need to know about radio direction finding. Radio direction finding gives you direction, not distance. I'm going to repeat this. Radio direction finding gives direction, not distance. Now, for those folks out there who, maybe a little bit thick and not quite understanding what I'm saying, it's very simple. Direction, not distance. These are the key words. I'm going to repeat this. Direction, not distance. This is very important to understand because this, even if Grogan was made up, if the Grogan story is made up, someone did a really bad job with this thing. If it isn't that messed up or someone didn't, that Grogan actually did hear what he heard, he actually proves that the strike force never, never, never broke radio silence. And here's why. Now, I'm going to give you kind of a brief, I'm going to try to do it as simple as possible as far as how radio works. Because radio signals, and of course, radio direction finding is what uses radio signals. Radio signals are directional. How to best explain this? Because when a radio station broadcasts, I'm going to refer more to, like your standard broadcast stations. Like if you listen to AM radio, FM radio, these signals emanate from an antenna and it radiates outwards. I mean, actually as large waves, radio magnetic waves. So, if you're wanting to listen to a radio station, and you may have actually experienced this, if you have a portable radio with an antenna that you can adjust, if you tune to your station and you move your antenna a little bit, you'll start getting a better signal. Well, in effect, you're doing radio direction finding. The idea is that the radio signals will, when it hits the antenna, and actually it's reality, when you point your antenna to the station, it's actually 90 degrees. So if you have the long antenna and you think you're pointing to, you think you're pointing in the right direction. If you follow the antenna, no, it's actually at 90 degrees. The station you're listening to is 90 degrees to your antenna. The better signal you get, the better the position of the antenna and you get closest to 90 degrees, you will get a better signal. This is how radio direction finding works. So in the case of there's different ways you can use radio direction finding. Now in this case, like with the lure line and its radio direction finding, the ship would use that to navigate to a particular point. A radio station on Hawaii would be broadcasting. You tune your radio and then adjust your antenna. It'll give you a direction to Hawaii. aircraft use it. You will see, if you look up Amelia Earhart and radio direction finding, you will actually see her holding a radio direction finding antenna. This may have been what caused her to lose, or if that radio failed on her way to Holland Island, she could have been way off course, type of thing. But the one way to do it, to use it, is to home in on a particular location. Again, aircraft use this all the time. Back in the 40s, it was probably a lot more important. You could tune in if you're heading to Chicago and you're somewhere over Iowa. No, without any landmarks to see. If you're at night, you tune your antenna. You can home in on Chicago or whatever city you wanted to go to or get close. That's one way radio direction finding works. The second, where you can actually get a position, you need multiple radio direction finding readings. It's called triangulation. You need 2, 3, 4 stations. The more you have, the closer you're going to get to your target. So, because the Lure Line was getting just direction, not distance, there's nothing in Grogan's report to say that there was any type of triangulation going on, no second or third reading of these signals. So those signals could either have been 10 miles, 100 miles, 1,000 miles, 10,000 miles away. There's nothing saying where those signals were actually emanating from. Now, the other part, if we're going to rely on Grogan's report, and actually I'm going to post this photo in the website so you can see it a little better. And as I explain this, if you strike a line from Hawaii to the northwest, no, northwest would have been 315 degrees. So if you strike a line starting in Hawaii on a great circle map with Hawaii being the center, what you will get is a line that it'll cross the Pacific, and the closest it's going to get to Japan is the Kuril Islands. Why is this important? The main Japanese Navy base, Hipotaku Bay, is in the Kuril Islands. Now, again, part of the story that never gets mentioned is that there was a effort to create a radio diversion that ships look that when the strike fleet assembled, a number of the radio operators on those ships were reassigned to smaller ships in and around Hipotaku Bay to emanate fleet radio signals. So, as the fleet, which would take off, taking a more northerly route, would literally disappear. There would be no way for the U.S. to spot these ships unless someone broke radio silence, which it didn't happen. The only signals that the U.S. Navy was hearing were these operators operating in home waters. And oddly enough, 14th Naval District was well aware or at least believe that the main battle fleet was still in Japanese home waters. So Grogan's story is consistent with this deception signal. Because the biggest problem is, because Grogan said northwest or west of northwest, that would be, again, this would be, these signals would be 315 degrees to about 300 degrees. The Japanese fleet on the second and third and fourth, I'm going to add the even extra day, the strike fleet was actually due north. So you would actually, if he would have said 350 degrees to 10 degrees, thus the Grogan story better supports the ships in home waters as opposed to the strike force. Now, so the question becomes, why would authors like Brian Villa and Timothy Wilford, who wrote Pearl Harbor Redefined, U.S. Navy Radio Intelligence in 1941, and this article in the Northern Mariner, Robert Stinnett, who repeats a similar story, why would even Tolan go out on a limb and claim that the Japanese had broken radio silence, when the fact of the matter is Grogan, and using Grogan's story as a basis, where clearly Grogan's story does not support their contention. So why do they press this forward? And I want to leave this more toward commentary. This is going to be more my opinion than any real fact. And actually going to, I am sure this might tick some people off. I hope it does, actually. Cause I'm still working pretty hard on other conspiracies. I'm working on a dirty electricity, you know, the Wi-Fi and all that and how it causes cancer. I want to do a show on that. I want to do a show on economics, economic conspiracies, money conspiracies. I've got a script ready or practically ready for a Bigfoot show. And during the research for the money side, I keep coming across the term, or at least the quote, the ends justifying the means. And this has struck me as this idea, or at least the belief that there's, and it actually rings kind of true with most conspiracy types, that it almost seems like they're not interested so much in the conspiracy. They will lie, cheat, steal, whatever they're going to do to get you to believe something, because their end game is to take money from your pocket. I mean, that's really if you're a listener of Cognitive Dissidence, and they're doing this, a series on David Icke and the reptilians and stuff like that. I mean, much of David Icke's stuff is, you know, total nonsense. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that reptilian aliens are controlling everything. What is Icke trying to do? Well, he's trying to get you to buy his books so he can live comfortably. Alex Jones does the same thing. He will lie, cheat, do whatever. And recently he started, I mean, I don't know how long ago he started this, but he's starting to sell, natural supplements and stuff like that, which, you know, if you're a skeptic, you're well aware of, much of this, you know, these natural, remedies don't work. So he's making money hand over fist, selling stuff that doesn't even work. So the idea is they need to get you to believe everything's poisoned, you're full of toxins, and if you take this stuff, you'll be right. And, you know, all they're really doing is ripping off hardworking people. I do see this in the, again, within the conspiracy world, to press forward a political agenda. The 9/11 truthers and the birthers and the, even the Newtown shooting hoax and all the shooting hoaxes, that the false flag stuff. These people don't care about the fact that people had died in Newtown. They didn't care that people died in, you know, Colorado or whatever. They're more worried about the government taking your guns away. And so they're going to make up whatever they can to say this was all make-believe and tell lies, basically. Because their end game is to prevent the Second Amendment from being taken out of the Constitution. They're afraid the government's coming to take their guns. I don't know what's really going to happen there. I really hope it doesn't come to that, but I doubt very much lying about these shootings is going to get any credibility. I don't want to hate picking on the libertarians, but there's a core group of libertarians out there who keeps promoting the 9/11 conspiracies and all these various conspiracies. Not so much that I don't know if they actually believe that the government is responsible for 9/11, but if they can paint the picture that the government is bad that we have now and we're better off having a libertarian president, these people are actually doing more damage to the libertarian cause than if they were honest and, you know, say, you know, the U.S. government is and has done some pretty shitty things in the name of democracy and you know, and freedom. I am hoping to do a show or something along that lines again, I've been doing more research. Hopefully I can get that either on this show or the Reverend Skeptics show. Kind of looking forward to that. So why press forward this idea that the Japanese broke radio silence? Well, again, it's the government lying, but there's what seems to be going on, at least in the Pearl Harbor conspiracies, in the lead up to our involvement, up to the attack on Pearl Harbor, there were a number of organizations that opposed the war. America First is the most well known of these organizations. There was a handful of other. There was a Catholic organization in Detroit. There was handfuls of those who had supported Germany, the Bundists. Even the Communist Party of America had opposed America's involvement in the Second World War. The attack on Pearl Harbor, and again, I want to make sure you understand this is my opinion. The war is, we're going to be mixed up in this war no matter what. Kind of a pessimistic view of the history, but the United States, we had a bullseye on us. And if it wasn't Pearl Harbor, it could have been something else. I could speculate all day on that. I'm not going to go down that, but it's quite possible if there wasn't a Pearl Harbor, probably the next best thing would be, the German U-boats in the North Atlantic would have got us mixed up with Germany. But there's, again, America First, who with various experts, guys like Charles Lindbergh and, General Wood, I don't even have all the names, but America First was saying that the U.S. was safe. We had no reason to be mixed up in a war in Europe. The war in Europe was Europe's problem, not America's problem. Certainly there was people, corporations who were profiting by selling goods to the Allies. So why rock the boat? Though there were those that were concerned about if Britain was conquered by Germany, would we get repaid for all the material we sold them? That was probably the only real worry Wall Street had, or the Wall Street banks had, during the war. But America First was convinced that we shouldn't have been in that war, that that Europe was not interested in the United States. We should have stayed out, but somehow Roosevelt maneuvered us into this war. That has been more or less the argument, at least from the conspiracy side. Guys like John T. Flynn wrote extensively. This guy did not like Roosevelt. He always wrote very negative stuff about Roosevelt, his policies. Anything he did, this guy didn't like. So by pressing forward the idea that Japan broke radio silence would have given credence to the anti-war movement. Anti-war movement was right and everyone else was wrong. And that perhaps, discredit the current government, that type of stuff. That seems to be more at what is going on, as opposed to actually finding out, did the Japanese break radio silence? No one has ever presented any evidence to support that the strike force broke radio silence. The strike force was under those orders. The rest of the Navy was not under those orders, so they could be talking all day long, as far as anyone was concerned. And the 14th District knew this. So that's why Grogan's story never really made it past the day officer in Honolulu. So to kind of wrap this show up, we've got two things going on here. One, was Grogan a figment of someone's imagination that wanted to create a story that Japan broke radio silence? Or was he a real person, gave a real report, and for some reason, experts decided Japan broke radio silence? I'm going to actually lean toward that Grogan was real. He was a real person. He gave a pretty decent report. Granted, the details are not there. I didn't go into a lot of the gorier stuff about the story, things like, he was listening to the 4,000 kilocycles, marine bands. That's where all these signals are being repeated. But Grogan's story actually adds up. It actually supports the government story that there was that they believe that the Japanese fleet was still in home waters, and that nowhere in the Grogan story made any indication that the strike fleet broke radio silence. So to kind of answer the listener question, much of what is in that in your the evidence in the paragraph. This evidence thus sheds entirely new light on the long controverted question of whether the attack force could maintain total radio silence during the 2-week voyage across the winter seas before arriving at the launching point for its planes. Veterans of the Kido Butai have insisted that the force maintain absolute and total radio silence until the attack planes began their final approach to Pearl Harbor. Some have chosen to attribute absolute veracity to these sources. That is, however, known that the same sources gave conflicting reports of the track of the force, denied the survival of any written records, and denied that Honolulu consulate had provided any intelligence for the Kido Butai. These inaccuracies have since been exposed. Well, there's really no inaccuracies. I don't see any in there. There's a part here about, as well, the Kido Butai stopped to refuel on 2 December, a fact that Grogan could not have been aware of by any other means other than radio direction finding in early December 1941. Well, according to the maps and everything, that the Japanese fleet did not stop, but they did refuel. They refueled on the move. That is definitely something wrong in the story. See, according to Grogan, that these were ships were bunched up waiting for orders. Again, this is from the Wilford writings. Again, the Grogan reports doesn't give cross bearings. There's no way to tell that these ships were near Pearl Harbor or halfway around the world, but it seems to be consistent with the ships still in home waters. Yes, they would be bunched up. It would look like they're not moving, which they weren't. So this is basically Wilford's assumption that the fleet stopped on the 2nd and 3rd. They did not. All the records, especially Nagumo's maps, the official maps, Japanese, everybody says they were moving on the 2nd and 3rd. The Japanese strike fleet was also due north of Hawaii. So again, Grogan does not give northerly coordinates or directions. He gives northwest coordinates. So again, he basically supports the ships still in home waters. Since we don't have cross-bearing references, you actually can't really say that is true, but the information Grogan gives is consistent with ships still in Japanese home waters. So Grogan himself, his story, debunks the story that's being attributed to him. All the authors from John Tolan, Robert Stinnett, Mark Emerson Wiley, Timothy Wilford, Brian Villa have consistently misrepresented the evidence and is literally perpetuating an untruth. I don't want to call them liars, but they're definitely, I'm going to say, at least in everyone but Tolan's case, they're just regurgitating a falsehood. Now, whether Tolan lied intentionally or not, I have no way of telling. I don't want to accuse him of lying. And because he is a respected author, got to give him some credit. I don't think he did anything on purpose, but perhaps was, again, led astray by experts. So, yeah, as far as I can tell and I'm concerned, Grogan's report and Grogan's story debunks the idea that the Japanese broke radio silence.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
So for announcements, I'm back. Hopefully I am currently working on a handful of shows, and I'm actually recording this show on September 6th. And once I get about three or four shows in the can, I'll start releasing them. So by the time once you start hearing this, I'll be back on a regular schedule. Work is finally letting up a little bit. I'm going to take some time to get my research together, get some shows in the can, and start getting back to a regular schedule. And with that, that's the only real announcement I have. I do want to recommend that if you have a chance and you're interested, check out, there's a few podcasts that I'm also involved with, the Reverend Skeptics. We're hoping to get back on air. Hopefully by the time you hear this, there might be a new show out for that. And I've been on occasion on Paul Carr's Unseen podcast. It's kind of an open forum, science, talking about space and space exploration and various kind of somewhat, it's a mix. Sometimes we talk about current events. We talked about the New Horizons mission and the Juno mission. I mean, we've talked about different things. There's Tabby Star was been talked about, but we talk about futurism. I think we've done some conspiracy shows and stuff like that. And I've been involved. I don't get involved too often, but if you want to hear some of the stuff I've done outside of this podcast, you'll find it there. Like I said, I've been working on trying to get a few shows together. I've got a plan for a Bigfoot conspiracy, dirty electricity, Wi-Fi, all that, those conspiracies. I've been trying to hammer through some of the economic and money conspiracies. I'm kind of afraid to tackle the conspiracies that Donald Trump, or one of our presidential candidates, there's been a lot of talk about him perpetuating various conspiracies. I don't know how or what'd be a good way to tackle that. And hopefully I can get back on a regular track and get these things out every 2 weeks or at least once a month. We'll see. I'm hoping to change up the format here a little bit. So you might have noticed I've gotten rid of some of the intro and outro songs. Not that I had to, but I just felt like perhaps look for some new intro music. Not that I'm in trouble with any copyright or anything like that. It's just thought I'd do it. I've been away for almost, I'll be probably coming up on a year by the time you hear this. Try to get back into the, try to do something a little different. And really, as far as announcements go, that's it. I do appreciate you hanging in there, keeping me in your RSS feeds. I will be trying to, hopefully this is going to be getting back to a regular show. I do appreciate all the listeners who have downloaded, listened, shared, talked, commented, and hopefully be doing this a lot more. Thank you.